This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We think of our bodies as being our own private property, but intimate subjects are often the stuff of public spectacle. And according to Duke professor Carla Holloway, the people most often victimized by such intrusions are women and minorities. In her new book, Private Bodies, Public Texts, she uses case studies to explore the ways in which the law and medicine have overlooked the rights of personal privacy. Carla Holloway is with us today, professor of English and a professor of law at Duke University. Welcome back, Carla. Good to have you here.
It's really good to be here. Thanks, Frank.
Tell us about this book. What were you investigating?
Well, it started with a consideration of privacy. Who gets it? Who gets the body? Maybe that comes from my look at death and dying in a book passed on. But it evolved very quickly into looking at the public spectacle of which bodies get negotiated in public. Terri Schiavo's body and the circus, really, literally, outside of her nursing home as she lay dying. And I started thinking about the most intimate, the most private moments we have, when we die, when and how we are born, you know, the reproduction issues, and now the contemporary issues around DNA. And then when we give our bodies away, the clinical trials issues. So how is privacy negotiated when we also have medical concerns and legal issues that intrude there? How do we keep things intimate when there are arguably public concerns about these issues? But we want to die quietly and at home with our loved ones.
These are concerns that affect us all, but you say they impinge most often on women and African Americans.
Let me tell you a story. And the book is full of stories. I think the most vulnerable bodies in medicine, and the vulnerable bodies is actually a term in bioethics, and we think about vulnerable populations as women, minorities, the elderly, disabled. But these are bodies often made vulnerable by our public opinions about them, and they sort of carry on the stereotypes or the issues which make us available for trials like the infamous Tuskegee syphilis experiment, or all of the stories we know of people who are in this persistent vegetative state, as was Terri Schiavo, if you think about it. Terri Schiavo, Nancy Cruzan, Elizabeth Bouvier, the ideas of these as being women whose stories we know suggested something to me about a divide between whom the media pays attention to, who we pay attention to, what stories can become public spectacles. So I started putting together my interest in privacy with which spectacles get told on television or in the newspaper, or and how that's connected to which bodies seem to be negotiated in public. Certainly with reproductive issues, it's about women, although arguably issues of the prostate are of concern to men, but we don't see public policies being developed around prostate health.
And again, if you go back to the Terri Schiavo example, I was trying to imagine if that had been a man. You mentioned three others. There is something, I guess, about a woman who is helpless, who we all have to rush in and help, that does play to type. And I found myself finding it was a little more difficult to imagine the news stories around a man in that position with the same story surrounding him.
There's also actually been some research on this by Stephen Miles, who found that when court cases deal with men and women in these situations, men are referred to by their last names, Mr. So-and-so, women by Terry or Elizabeth or Nancy. Women are in fetal positions. Men are described with the medical term, which is having contractures when they're. So even the language shifts. We do think about women as infantilized, needing help, needing our public attention in order to mediate their death. And you're right. It's the way in which our society has negotiated the roles around gender that makes, you know, a Terri and Schiavo much more palatable to the media than if it had been a male in that situation.
And you say the Tuskegee experiment is also instructive for a couple of reasons, not only because of the clear implication that this was carried out on African-American men, but our sense that it's in our past is also instructive.
Yeah, this bothers me a lot. And I started thinking about this when I wondered in teaching bioethics and my medicine courses and in talking with bioethicists, why Tuskegee is a story that always comes up, because there are plenty of stories in the 1980s, the 1990s, the 21st century, which also indicate that there have been harms done to populations of minorities, children, the elderly. But Tuskegee keeps coming up. And in this book, I suggest that perhaps Tuskegee keeps coming up because we can also tie it to a familiar narrative of sexuality and black males. So whenever we talk about Tuskegee, we also bring up this issue of syphilis. And this seems to come together in a neat package, which I think is much more publicly interesting. I don't think that's the public intent, but I think that's the consequence of always talking about Tuskegee and not what happened in Baltimore with lead abatement studies in minority populations, or what happened on the West Coast with a measles vaccine experimental trial in the 1980s and 90s. So why don't we know these stories with as much power as we know Tuskegee? I think it has to do with race and gender.
And stories around Hurricane Katrina as well, even more recent than that.
Right. Who was rescued? Who was available? Which bodies were negotiated around in Memorial Medical Center and eventually euthanized? So the issues that remained in Katrina showed a great divide. Even the language around the refugee population of the victims of Hurricane Katrina was an othering of that population that suggested these black and poor people were different from the people who are not. And what happened to them, and what I tell a story in this book, which has been paid attention to in the New York Times in great detail, and I think in a book coming out about what happened at Memorial Medical Center with patients who ended up having excess levels of morphine in their bodies. And so something happened to them in the final hours. They were all black women. The physician left was a white woman. What does the racial divide mean? It's a difficult engagement, but it's necessary for us to think of the ways in which, even though medicine and law are arguably neutral, we want the balance of justice and the neutrality of medicine, we bring ourselves wherever we go. So those beliefs we have about which bodies are available, which ones are precious, which ones are not so precious, follow us into our professions.
So in some ways, as we enter into this brave new world of bioethics and biomedicine and genetic research and all the questions it raises for us, we may not be prepared to even begin those discussions until we come to terms with the ways that we subtly and subconsciously view race and gender in our commerce that preceded all that.
I think that's it. And the preceding is particularly important to me. I do know and understand my friends who are physicians and who are scientists, and the physicians in particular, they need to make a decision. The law needs to narrow something to a legal question. But I want to remember, I want my students especially to remember, so what are the stories that are left out? When we narrow something to the answerable question for the law or the determinative solution for medicine, what are we leaving out? So all of this interest in a patient's story and the stories of law, I repeat some fiction in the book so that we get a sense of what the thickness of a story actually is. Not that the facts of our lives need to be replaced by fictions, but we need to know that narratives are thick. And as we go towards medical solutions, when we're making decisions with historical patterns and precedents following right alongside. And I want folks to be aware of what those patterns and precedents are, especially when it comes to those populations we have rendered vulnerable, women and minorities.
Talking with Carla Holloway, her latest book is Private Bodies, Public Texts, Race, Gender, and Cultural Bioethics. You talked about the value of literature. Tell us about that in particular, what literature you use in this book, why you think that should be perhaps more important in these or included in our conversations about ethics.
Well, it's interesting that many medical school curricula are now going to medical ethics in the humanities, and humanities often means arts and literature. I have been very concerned that the interest in a patient's story is still much too narrow, so I introduce fiction. I use Kazuo Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, which is a story about, I'm giving it away here, a group of school children who are cloned in Britain in what Ishiguro says it was in the 1900s or in the year 2000. So he puts it in our contemporary era to suggest the decisions that we make about cloning are not things of a horrific future or an unimaginable future or a horrific past. They are with us today. And the normalcy and the quietness of Ishiguro's story. He's a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. I actually read him first in a class when I was in law school in literature and law. And so in putting this story into the book, I thought that we would be able to deal with the complexity of how we deal with populations who are very, very similar to us. The cloned children look like any other children, and yet the utilization of their bodies for society's needs until they died is a critical part of who they are. And the normalcy of his and the quietness of his storytelling was important to me. And it was a way in which I think the reader and my students who will eventually be reading that book as well as mine get a sense of how complex these narratives are. When I talk about death and dying, I use a wonderful drama by Margaret Edson, Wit, which could be a long story about a clinical trial or a story about death and dying. But this happens to be an English professor who finds herself with ovarian cancer and the patient of one of her former students who took her Dunn class. And so John Dunn and death and dying and clinical trials are all woven together in a story I thought was not inappropriate for me as an English professor.
Well, and it illustrates how powerful the imagination is, and that's we bring an awful lot to any one of these discussions, whether we're an expert in the field of bioethics or genetic engineering or, you know, simply somebody who goes to the polls to vote for somebody who makes those decisions. There's an awful lot that we carry with us. And you've said that recent coverage of tornadoes and tornado victims is a pretty good illustration of this.
Well, I've been watching the news, of course, and riveted by the coverage of the tornadoes, but also looking at it critically and noting how much of the storytelling is focused on women and children. And although men are certainly victims of these tornadoes, the stories that make it to the news are women holding their children or children walking bereft around the empty terrain, a tornado-emptied terrain, a terrain I know very well because we lost our own home to a tornado in the 1980s in Michigan. And so the way in which the media sort of inculcates its population to think that the bodies that can hold these stories are going to be women, but they also become available and open. So what happened to you? Tell us. How did you feel? What did you think? This is a person who, non-traumatized, might think 3 or 4 months later, why did I tell that reporter, you know, this detail? But in a traumatic situation, when we are literally at our most psychically vulnerable, we are normally storytellers, and we are open to probing and interest and telling our stories. So I want us to be careful of which bodies become available to carry those necessary stories of what happens in a disaster. But I want us to be a bit more balanced about what we think might make a good read on the evening news.
What do we do? Is this something we handle as individuals? Do we empty ourselves so that we can be open to new possibilities instead of asking for the same old fairy tale told over and over?
I think we complicate ourselves. I think we fill it with as much information as possible and then be introspective and critical about why this story rather than that one. What does this person tell me differently than another? What would it mean if I had a straight white male telling this story rather than a gay female telling this story? So when we talk about sexuality, when we think about reproductive issues, there's a lot in this book about in vitro fertilization and the stories about reproductive clinic errors and what happens when white people bear black babies and, you know, all of the titillating news stories. I want us to think about the bodies that matter and what it means for a person to make themselves public in a moment when they might not have the screen that we might be able to provide for them. So I suggest a certain mindfulness and a complication of the way in which we think that bodies are available for public spectacle.
And it works, again, on two levels. Sometimes when I put the mic in your face, you seem to have granted some kind of permission.
License, certainly.
But clearly you're under duress. And other times when the law simply appropriates the right to
Absolutely.
Talk for you.
Now that's where, you know, the issues of gathering DNA are very interesting to me. And you know, direct-to-consumer marketing of DNA tests now. So how do we negotiate that data gathering? Have we given it away before we've thought carefully about it? I actually think we have. That doesn't mean we can't be reflective, though.
Thank you for helping us in this reflection. Carla, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Frank.
Carla Holloway is a professor of law and a professor of English at Duke University. Her newest book is called Private Bodies, Public Texts. Carla's going to read from that book at the Durham County Library on July 17, 3 o'clock. For more information about Carla Holloway and her work, you can go to carlaholloway.com. Carla is spelled with a K. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Check us out on Facebook as well. The State of Things is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Anna Cassell and Galvin Wells are our interns. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.